Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Right now, in Washington, D.C., a Democratic senator from Connecticut has launched a filibuster demanding a vote on gun control measures. This, of course, comes 3 days after 49 people were shot dead, 53 more wounded in Orlando, Florida. Senator Chris Murphy is holding up action on the Senate floor, demanding that Republicans allow votes on these gun control measures. He also referred to the 2012 shooting in his home state, when 20 children and 6 adults were shot at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. He says he cannot look into the eyes of the children's families and tell them that Congress has done nothing since. We are tweeting out a link to a live video of that Senate filibuster as it's happening. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. Now, as you know, that Orlando, Florida gunman apparently targeted this nightclub, Pulse, because it was a gay club. He knew that virtually everyone inside was gay. Does that sound old-fashioned to you? Haven't we moved past the time of separate places for gay people? Stranger editor Dan Savage has been thinking about the relevance of the gay nightclub in Seattle and beyond.
I don't think it's an anachronistic thing. There's been a lot of writing. You know, if you right now, there's so much writing celebrating gay clubs and how necessary they are and how important they are to people's coming out, to people feeling that there's this place where they're safe. And if you Google it right now, gay bars disappearing, you will find tons of articles written about the demise of the gay bar and so many gay bars and lesbian bars all over the country closing. And you'll find people celebrating the demise of the gay bar and saying, we don't need it anymore. So there's some kind of whiplash because all the think pieces prior to the shooting were about the demise and the end of the gay bars, some celebrating it. All the think pieces now are about the need for, the necessity of, and the importance and place of gay bars. And I actually fall into the latter category. I think gay bars are the new vinyl. You know, when digital music downloads came along, that was supposed to be the end of the CD, and also the CD was supposed to be the end of vinyl. And now vinyl is booming, but never really left. And there are these devotees of vinyl recording. And there are, the gay bars never really went away. Some went away. There was less need for as many of them as we once had because they used to be our only safe space. Now we have multiple safe spaces. I'm sure people who are queer who work here at KUOW feel like this is a safe space for them to be out. They don't have to go to the gay bar in the U District that doesn't exist anymore to be out for 10 minutes. They can be out at work. I feel, and many gays and lesbians and bi and trans people are now fortunate enough to feel comfortable being out to our families, and our families of origin feel like safe spaces for us. But a gay bar is also a safe space, but it's a safe space that intersects, if I can use that word, that's so overused, it intersects with desire and lust and opportunity. And, you know, you're not going to get, if you're an openly queer person at KUW, you're probably not going to get laid at work today. And when you're home for a family reunion, as Terry and I were this weekend, we're not going to get laid in that safe space at the family reunion, hopefully, thank God. But going to a gay bar, there's this camaraderie, there's this feeling of opportunity, and this feeling of not just safety, but possibility and chance. And that's very alluring. Like the gay bar is a place that's safe, but also a place of desire and action, not in the getting it on sense of action, but you are taking action in this way.
Besides camaraderie and desire, you also wrote about how important it is that a gay club is a place of joy.
And that refutes the lie. You know, when I was growing up, there was no Glee, there was no internet, there were no openly gay characters on television, there were no openly gay figures in the media, there were no openly gay, lesbian, bi, or trans elected officials. There was nothing, there was silence. And the lie that we were all told by our parents, by our peers, by our churches, by the medical establishment, by our elected officials, by our government, was that to be queer, to be gay, was to be miserable, it was to be alone, it was to have a life without joy in it. And as a teenager, the first time I went into a big gay disco, Paradise, it was called, on Broadway in Chicago, I saw with my own eyes that all of that was not true. I saw with my own eyes groups of friends. I saw men with their lovers. I saw people experiencing and creating profound sense of joy in a really pressure cooker environment. It was the early 80s, and there wasn't a lot of places you could be out. You did need to be behind kind of a wall and in secret and in private to be out at that time for a lot of people. And there was just this electric sense of release and joy. And it just refuted the lie that had been told to us. And I saw it with my own eyes. I smelled it. You could taste it in the air. You could smell the booze. You could smell the poppers. You could smell the sweat. And you could see the joy. And that was really important. And it was instantaneously transformative. Now, queer kids growing up now, do they need the gay bar? Do they need that place when they can get online and find support? They can get online and find each other. They can get on apps and find romantic possibilities. But what we hear from young queer kids, and a lot of the, you know, the youngest victims at Pulse nightclub were 18 and 19 years old, that they still need to see it and smell it and taste it and witness it, that digital remove isn't enough. And so there's still this desire to clump up, to congregate, to get together. Tinder hasn't destroyed the straight bar, and Grindr isn't going to destroy the gay bar.
Well, I don't know the scene in Orlando, Florida, but especially in Seattle, you know, we know that not only has America realized, hey, gay people are our friends and neighbors and coworkers, but we know, especially in Seattle, that it's more interesting than straight or gay, that there's a big range of human experience. Don't gay clubs kind of breathe life into whole either-or labels?
Straight people will sometimes say that. You know, why do we need these labels? Why can't we all just be human? Why do we need a club that's just a gay club? Why can't we just have clubs? And you can say that when you're 90-ish plus percent of the population. Because if you fill a bar with a representative sample of everyone, your possibilities for romance, for connection, are not diminished. The gay guy or the lesbian or the bisexual person or the trans person, their possibilities for connection or romance are diluted, if not completely destroyed, are very much diminished. You know, we're a very small percentage of the population. We need places and spaces where we can go, where we are going to be for that time and in that spot, the majority. The assumption is that people are straight because almost all people are straight. So straight people can say no labels because you're going to be accurately labeled by default. The assumption made about you is going to be correct. But gay people, we need to put the label on ourselves like we're, you know, a soup can, because the label that is placed upon us by the culture and by that assumption is inaccurate and it makes us invisible to each other. We need to label ourselves so that we can find each other.
So I take it you're not a fan of straight people partying at Neighbors and Wild Rose? And
I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I've certainly taken some straight friends to gay bars myself. It's weird. You know, the control on gay people being a little out of control in a straight bar is fear of violence. Like, we're not going to make out on a dance floor in an overwhelmingly straight club, not out of respect for the heterosexuality in the room, but out of fear of violence, not from all the straight people in the room, but from the kinds of straight people who react violently when they see gay people being gay. And straight people don't, you know, go into a lot of queer clubs and they don't fear violence. And so they don't, there's no control on them acting super straight. And gay people don't necessarily have a problem with that. I've never seen a straight couple dancing at Neighbors when I was young enough to still be going to Neighbors who got any grief from anybody. But you reach this tipping point sometimes where there's so many straight people in a gay club that the gay sense of community and camaraderie and the assumption that I'm in a place where I can assume everybody's gay, that goes away and it makes the space feel not gay. It makes it feel not queer. It makes it feel not ours.
What about Pride Fest, the Pride Parade? You really want me bringing all my straight friends?
Absolutely. I love the way they do it in Australia, the Sydney Mardi Gras, it's called. And it's a parade and queer people and queer groups march, and it's mostly straight people that come watch. And queer people who bitch about straight people being at the Pride Parade are unclear on the concept of the whole mission of the Pride Parade. It's about visibility and not just making ourselves visible to each other, but making ourselves visible to the wider community, manifesting in the streets and demanding the right to be in the streets, demanding the right to be seen and to be safe. And we used to only be able to be seen and be safe in great numbers. And that was one of the missions of the Pride Parade, was let's gather so many of us together at one place at one time that the cops can't arrest us all and the bigots can't beat us all up. And now it's shifted. It's different. And it's about asserting the right to space that we've claimed. But it's also about still about being seen and about being seen by straight people.
What do you want from this year's Pride Month? Anger, oh, protest, God. March, I defiant joy.
You know, what we mark, what we celebrate in June, and what the Pride parades commemorate are the riots at the Stonewall Inn in New York City in 1969. It really was the catalyst for the modern lesbian, gay, bi, trans civil rights movement. There was a gay rights movement before Stonewall. There's the Mattachine Society, the Daughters of Bilitis. There were activists who took just staggering risks and were out in the 40s and 50s in this country in the early 60s. But it was an attack on a gay bar waged by the state. Cops went into Stonewall to arrest the patrons there and to terrorize and harass them. And now, you know, here we are in 2016 and we are well into Pride Month. We're about to have the Pride Parade here in Seattle, about to have the Pride Parade in New York City commemorating the Stonewall riots. And there's been an attack on a gay bar. And it's devastating. And it's, you know, I spent all day Sunday writing and crying. But it wasn't an attack waged by the state. And there is a difference, and a significant and important one. So we cannot succumb to despair. We cannot look at what happened in Orlando and lie to ourselves and tell us that nothing has changed and nothing has gotten better, because so much has changed and so much has gotten better. We can't see violence and hatred and then tell ourselves nothing has changed, nothing has gotten better. We have to look to the response to that violence and hatred, or the source of that violence and hatred. And the source 40, 50 years ago was the state, the police, politicians, our families, the church, the media, the medical establishment. And the response was an endorsement of that violence. And look at the response to the attack on gay people, and not just gay people, straight people died there. There was a woman at Pulse with her son, a 50-year-old two-time cancer survivor, who was at Pulse that night with her son and his friends. And her son survived because when the shooting started, she jumped in front of him, between him and the shooter, and she died. Oh my God, it's just devastating to think about. And this straight woman sacrificed her life to save her gay son. And if you're a gay man of my generation, you remember when a time when the mothers of gay men who were in the hospital dying of AIDS wouldn't come visit their dying children, wouldn't collect their bodies, wouldn't bury them. Just complete rejection. And that was the norm. You know, there was a time, God, I'm sorry I'm being such a weepy bag of slop. There was a time at Pride Parades, you know, 30 years ago, when the parents of friends and lesbians and gays came down the street and everybody lost it. Recall these adult gays and lesbians who had no relationships with their families of origin, who'd been cruelly rejected by their parents and their siblings, who had, many of them, no straight friends at all that they could risk being out to, they could risk being known by. Parents and friends would come down the street and people would stand there sobbing because you didn't have that. And almost none of us did at that time. And now parents and friends of lesbians and gays, PFLAG, they come down the street, people are cheering, people are moved, but it's no longer the exception to have a loving and accepting family. And that in and of itself is evidence of the progress made. I don't know how I got off onto this tangent about PFLAG. I don't remember what I was talking about before.
I asked you what attitude you want to see at this year's Pride Fest. Because people, some people are talking, you know, protest march. Some people are saying, as I said, defiant joy.
They tell us we're miserable. They tell us we shouldn't exist. They tell us that we don't exist, that no one is gay or lesbian or bi, that these are just sins or choices. And so to be in public and to exist and be joyful is a political statement. So I would like the Pride Parade to be a joyful party, and also to, for it to be defiant. It wasn't just the attack on Pulse this week. They also arrested a man on his way to the Pride Parade in West Hollywood mm-hmm. with a car packed with explosives and half a dozen weapons, and he was going there to kill people. So here on the West Coast, we averted a disaster that could have been nearly as bad or worse as the outrage in Orlando. And I don't want people to be cowed or fearful. Then they win. You know, they win when we cower, and they win when we stop fighting. And we're not going to cower, and we're not going to stop fighting.
Dan Savage, editorial director at The Stranger, Savage Love, columnist, podcaster. That's a part of our conversation. We talked about a lot, as we always do when Dan comes in. We're going to put that entire conversation online for you, and you can find it later today at kuow.org. Sunday night after the shooting at the Orlando nightclub Pulse, Seattle and Tacoma both held vigils to commemorate the people who were killed and to grieve together. People have been posting about their grief and anger on social media, and you just heard Stranger editor Dan Savage a moment ago talking about how he wants his city to react to those shootings here during Pride Month. This morning, on the C Line bus from West Seattle, KUOW's senior editor Jim Gates witnessed another response to the Orlando shooting. Hi, Jim.
Hey there, Bill.
Will you tell us what happened on your bus ride into work this morning?
Yeah, like you said, I was riding the C Line, and the bus was crowded. It was packed, and everybody's just sort of staring at their smartphones like they do, you know, in their own little worlds. And we were just about to cross over the Seattle Bridge, the West Seattle Bridge, and then suddenly this guy right next to me just starts singing. At the top of his lungs, he belts out, "What the world needs now is love." And I was just kind of shocked, and the whole bus sort of stared at him, surprised. And then towards the end of the song, I grabbed my smartphone and recorded just the end of it.
Love, sweet love, it's the only thing that there's just you live love.
Who is this guy, Jim? Why was he singing?
Well, that was Daniel Tidwell. He works at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, and he's the alumni programs coordinator. He said he was singing in response to the Orlando, Florida shootings.
Well, so the bus was like packed full of people. We were kind of here like sardines, and so it was like ghostly quiet on the bus. And just after the events of this weekend, and my own just moving through grief and sadness, just realized, like, oh, it's way too quiet in here for me to go this whole way into Seattle without anybody saying anything to each other. To do something to remind people to reach out to each other. So that's as much for me as for everybody else.
So Daniel told me he wanted to bring a little light to people's day and connect with them. And I asked him if he normally sings on buses, and he said he's an introvert and this was completely unlike him.
You said this is a crowded bus, Jim. How did the other passengers react to Daniel's rendition of "What the World Needs Now is Love"?
Well, you know, it did prompt a little conversation. One woman next to me suggested singing "Zippity-Doo-Dah," but nobody had the courage to start it up.
My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I can imagine people going home tonight and talking to their loved ones and saying, you know what, I was on the bus today and some guy just started belting out "What the World Needs Now is Love." So I think Daniel did get a conversation going.
Yeah, I think he did too. So beyond his bursting into song, you talk more to Daniel about handling mm-hmm. the grief out of the Orlando shooting.
Yeah, and he was quite reflective. And he said you can't really move past it. What you have to do is just sort of be with it.
There are things that break us open, and so we have to go deeper, feel the grief, but also then that's how we can sort of feel love and repair and grow. We can't just brush it off with the news cycle. We kind of have to allow it to keep affecting us in a way that grows deeper compassion.
Let the grief affect us to grow deeper compassion. That advice over the bus announcement came to you today from Daniel Tidwell, spontaneous Seattle bus singer, and KUOW senior editor Jim Gates. Thanks for pulling out your iPhone and sharing the story with us.
Thank you.
What about you? Are you moving through grief over this massacre? How do you do that? We would all like to know. Call and tell us how you handle grief. Our feedback line is 206-221-3663. 221-3663. You can also email us with your thoughts and your stories on processing grief. Our email address is record@kuow.org, and we might use your comments on the air. And you know we're live tweeting the program on Twitter. We're at KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle, news and information. A couple of weeks ago, a Union Pacific train derailed in the Columbia River Gorge in Mosier, Oregon, and spilled 42,000 gallons of crude oil. Months before that, the railroad lobbied against rules that would have increased regulation on oil trains moving through the Northwest. The railroad industry lost here in Washington State, but in Oregon it won. Reporters Conrad Wilson and Tony Schick have more on how things played out in each state.
On March 18th of last year, the Senate Committee on Energy and the Environment held a hearing in Olympia. The committee was taking testimony on a bill that would require railroads to submit plans for how they would respond to an oil train derailment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brock Nelson. I'm Director of Public Affairs for Union Pacific Railroad.
Nelson and other railroad lobbyists didn't like the bill. They argued federal law didn't allow for what the state was trying to do. They even told lawmakers railroads had sued over similar rules in the past.
Meanwhile, in Oregon, lawmakers were considering a similar bill that would give Oregon regulators oversight of railroad emergency response. The bill would also create a tax on railroads to fund the state's own planning for oil train derailments. On April 9th of last year, lobbyist Brock Nelson gave lawmakers in Salem the long list of problems Union Pacific had with the bill.
Section 1, Part 13, using the phrase high hazard creates a feeling of apprehension in the mind of the public and implies every train traversing the route carries hazmat. The railroad industry.
The bill was later gutted. It was replaced with entirely new language and trimmed from nearly 12 pages to less than two. Lawmakers removed the requirements for railroads. Instead, they told the state's fire marshal to come up with an oil train response plan. So that means Oregon now lags behind both Washington and California on regulating oil trains.
Both those states now tax oil by rail to fund spill prevention. They also require the railroads to submit their emergency response plans for testing and approval, and they require railroads show whether they can cover the cost of a derailment.
Oregon doesn't do those things. But we should point out railroads in Oregon have agreed to cooperate with first responders. They've even purchased some equipment and offered training.
I feel as though they, you know, they're not the enemy here. They are in a situation where this is their job and they want it to be, you know, they want it to go safely and well just as much as we do.
Representative Barbara Smith Warner sponsored the oil train bill in the Oregon legislature. The Democratic lawmaker says she realized the bill wouldn't pass as written. So she could either stick to the same language and hope it passed in a few years.
Or you start with your ideal and you negotiate.
Washington lawmakers face the same intensity of lobbying that squashed the rules in Oregon.
They certainly had a phalanx of lobbyists who, tracked every single moment the bill was moving through the process.
Washington State Representative Jessen Farrell, a Democrat, sponsored the bill in Olympia. On May 14th, it was signed into law. It gave state regulators the same authority over oil trains that it's had over marine vessels, pipelines, and refineries for years.
If our requirements sound like they're very rigorous, they are.
Dave Byers manages oil spill planning for the Department of Ecology.
Washington State has the highest standards of perhaps any state in the nation, higher expectations than the federal government has.
As for those rules in Oregon?
We don't really have any.
Scott Smith is a spill planner with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. His agency has strong rules in place to ensure pipelines, ships, and oil terminals are prepared for spills, but not oil trains.
We don't have the ability to do pre-planning and the drills and exercises. We don't go through their plans every 5 years, and we don't have any authority over them.
So Oregon's still trying to catch up.
Take this month's oil train derailment on the Oregon side of the Columbia River Gorge, for example. The Washington Department of Ecology sent 22 people, two boats, and a helicopter.
Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality had just 7 people to send. I'm Tony Schick.
And I'm Conrad Wilson
in Mosier, Oregon.
And I'm Bill Radke at KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information, bringing you the record here on June 15th. January, chilly this morning. Well, with June being the traditional wedding month, KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman met up with a Seattle chef who makes edible art, including wedding cakes. This is the latest in Marcy's series, Art of Our City.
After the vows and the champagne toasts and the happy couple's first dance, the centerpiece of every wedding is the cake. But you can banish the notion of a three-tiered white wonder.
I definitely do get the occasional client that wants just a traditional white cake with a bride and groom on top, but I definitely encourage my clients to get a little bit creative and to try to design a cake with me that reflects their personalities.
Pastry chef Kevin Mulder has fielded all kinds of cake requests after a decade in the business, from psychedelic icing to a three-dimensional cougar sculpted from cake. It's amazing what he can do with sugar, flour, and butter. Mulder's cakes are visually stunning, but they have to taste good, too.
I think that the taste is what's going to make your guests at your wedding remember, but I also think that the look is just as important.
Summertime is Mulder's busy season. He'll meet with dozens of couples to help make their wedding cake dreams come true. But Kevin Mulder isn't tempted by the sweet confections that surround him.
I am not a cake person. I love brownies. Brownies is my jam.
Now there's an idea, a wedding cake built of brownies. From East Lake Union, that's The Art of Our City. I'm Marcy Silman.
And you'll find some of Kevin Mulder's cakes at our website, KUOW.org. You'll find all of Marcy's art stories on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram. Look for the hashtag Art of Our City. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This is what a high school girl had to say about how she looks. My whole life is an attempt to figure out what I actually like versus what I want to hear from other people, or wanting to look a certain way to get attention. And part of me feels cheated out of my own well-being because of that. That high school student was talking to author Peggy Orenstein. Orenstein told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel that struggle girls experience over how they're supposed to look, it starts early on, something Orenstein discovered while writing her first book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter.
You know, so much of how girls are taught to present themselves is about pleasing, is about, you know, defining femininity through being desirable rather than understanding any aspect of your own desire. And a big part of that now is being hot. You know, being hot is more important than anything. You have to be hot first. I mean, you see that everywhere, even in feminism. You know, one girl said to me, could Beyonce say what she's saying if she didn't look the way she looked? You know, do you have to be hot even before you can get a feminist message out? And hot is this just very narrow, superficial, commodified idea about what's attractive that tells girls over and over that how their body looks to somebody else is more important than understanding how that body feels to them. Whereas women of a different generation, baby boom women or Gen X women, may have seen that idea as a kind of push towards self-objectification or self-sexualization. Young women today consider and are sold that idea as confidence and power. And so one of the girls that I talked to, you know, as an example, just showed me a picture of herself in a crop top and a short skirt and high heels going out to a party. And she said, I'm proud of my body and I never feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothing. And a few minutes later, she said she wouldn't have worn that same outfit a year earlier because, as she put it, some jerky boy would have called me the fat girl, and that would have been bad for my mental health. And so then, you know, you have to ask, well, who gets to be proud of which body, under what circumstances, and who decides that? And how liberating can it be if humiliation lurks just around the corner?
How has this affected your own thinking about gender and what it means to be a woman versus what it means to be a man and how that's represented?
Well, I guess it affects me very much as a mother. You know, I think very hard about wanting my daughter. I try to take the long view, you know, with my daughter, particularly obviously she's not sexually active. She's in seventh grade, but I think about what I want for her. And I think about what I want for her in her sexual relationships, whether those are also intimate emotional relationships or not. I think about what I want for her in the workplace. I think about how I want her to present in the world. And so we discuss all of these things. And when we talk about how women's bodies are portrayed in the culture, you know, I want her to notice that difference. And I want her to notice that that doesn't have any connection with how their bodies feel. And I, you know, we talk about the selfie culture. We had a conversation the other day where she had gone on a field trip and, out to the beach, and you know, I live in Northern California, so it's cold and nasty at the beach, and the wind was whipping and the sand was stinging. And she said, nonetheless, several of her classmates got into their bikinis, her female classmates, and took Instagram photos that they posted of the fun, frolicking time they were having on the beach. And she said, Mom, you know, that was a lie. That wasn't, why do they want to put up something about their lives that's a complete lie so that other people can think they're having a good time? And I sort of said, honey, if you can hold that thought for the next 7 years or so, I will have done my job.
I was just thinking that how great it is that she's able to recognize that in seventh grade, but it may not necessarily be the same for her when she's in 11th grade.
Exactly. I don't know. Right now, she's not on social media, so she's not being raised by it, and she's not absorbing its rules and roles for women as part of her identity. But I don't know, you know, that will not be forever. And social media is one of the things that has, I don't think it's caused any of this, but it reinforces and amplifies the ways that girls are encouraged to present. I mean, every girl knows that you're going to get more likes if you put up a bikini shot than if you put up a shot of yourself in the parka. And and the likes and the comments, which are very, you know, it's a language that we don't really speak, the language of comments, but that girls know exactly what it means. If you say cute versus gorgeous versus, you know, versus, oh, you're so hot, you know, whatever. Those things all have particular shades of meaning, but they're all about how you look. The comments are always, it's always about expressing yourself. Girls talk about expressing yourself, but it's expressing yourself in how you look, not who you are, what you do, what your character is, what you're good at, what you enjoy. It's a very narrow idea of self-expression for the most part.
You've brought up your daughter a couple of times, and you even gave an example of her being able to see other girls that she goes to school with kind of fake something in order to present themselves a certain way, wearing bikinis at a freezing beach. How do you have conversations with her that, I don't know, how do you build a foundation so that these things she's thinking about now stick, that they stay with her when she's 15, when she's 20. And I'll be honest, I'm asking as the mother of a 4-year-old girl. I have no idea how to have these conversations with my daughter and how to protect her from
I know.
This.
Why would you, though? Why would you? You know, because who had them with you? You know, so I mean, honestly, I have been talking to my daughter about these things since she was 4 years old in you know, a little 4-year-old way. Like, why do you, when we watch Despicable Me 2, you know, I don't know if you've seen that, but there's this character, it's just a random thing that I'm picking, but there's a female character who's supposed to be the strong female character in that movie. She's a detective or something. And in the whole movie, she's, first of all, her eyes are bigger than her waist. And secondly, she's wearing high heels. And through the whole movie, and I, at some point I said, hey, I wonder how she runs in those high heels. Doesn't a detective have to run to catch the bad guys? That's kind of weird, huh? I mean, just sort of pointing that stuff out when kids are little, for boys too, you know, I think is important. Now, honestly, that my daughter's more towards a teenager and getting to that age where a lot of kids will plug their ears and hum and run from the room if you bring up sex. What I did, I cheated, and you can cheat the same way by, you know, by listening to interviews like this. I took her to a couple of my events that I was doing for the book. She's come to a couple interviews with me, and those things open up a lot of conversation between us. And I've heard a lot of people, you know, even more than the book itself, the media that I've done around the book, like an interview like this, they listen to it with their teenagers, and it's a way to enter into that conversation. And by the time a child is in ninth grade, I think, or a rising ninth grader, they can read this book. It's accessible to them, and it's a great book to read in tandem with your child in order to discuss these issues. And, you know, you have to have an entry point. And what I found is that girls, if given the entry point, they can see things are unfair, and they are trying to struggle to figure out how to create a context that works for them, too. So we just need to give them the opportunity and kind of get over our own squeamishness about it.
Peggy Orenstein is the author of the new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She talked with Jeannie Yandel there. Orenstein also has an essay in the current issue of Mother Jones. It's called Our Barbie Vaginas Ourselves, The Troubling Divide Between Sex Positive and True Confidence. If you live in a country where there's risk of exposure to the Zika virus, don't get pregnant. That's the best advice from the World Health Organization. There are two confirmed cases of Zika virus in King County. There's no vaccine. How should our public health officials be responding? Dr. David Fleming was director and health officer for Public Health Seattle in King County. Now he's vice president of public health at PATH in Seattle. I asked him how he thinks we're doing.
It does seem to me, at least from the accounts that I read and the friends that I know that are trying to make things happen, that the importance of the Zika epidemic to the country is we're losing sight of it, and it's turning more into more of routine politics, polarization, discussions back and forth about strategy for who's going to win, as opposed to how do we make this a win for the American public.
What are we losing sight of?
Well, we're losing sight of the fact that we have a new disease that, for the first time, is entering our country. It's one of the first diseases that's been a significant risk here that's spread by mosquitoes. It's the only disease spread by mosquitoes that causes birth defects. And with summer coming, we're losing time in helping finance the preparations that need to occur within our public health system to lessen its impact.
What does our public health system need to be doing that we should finance?
Well, there's a range of things. Unfortunately, for Zika virus, there is no vaccine. There's no magic bullet cure. And so we are stuck with less than optimum strategies to control it. In particular, it's spread by mosquitoes. And so in places in the country where that's a risk, the mosquito population can be at least partly controlled through effective management. But in many places, the vector control programs that do this work have been either underfunded or defunded altogether. And so there are no programs in place. Those need to be assessed and built rapidly. Second, a fair amount of the prevention strategy is education and making sure at the local level that people who are at risk are educated about that risk and the steps that they can take to prevent mosquito bites. And then finally, we're going to have people who are sick and who are pregnant and who need medical attention, and therefore we need to really beef up our communications and the connection functions that our local health departments have. And that includes really good advice to women who are considering pregnancy about there are risks and benefits of that at this time and access to contraception if they decide to defer pregnancy.
How much of a risk is the Zika virus here in Western Washington?
Well, the good news is that in Western Washington, the mosquitoes that we have, and obviously we have mosquitoes, are not the ones that spread Zika. So we are not going to be seeing large numbers of cases. Well, there are cases in Western Washington already from people who have traveled to parts of the U.S. or parts of the world where Zika is common, so we will see cases here. And then there is a low level of transmission from person to person, including sexual transmission.
Two confirmed cases in King County that we know of, right?
Exactly.
What precautions should a listener to you right now take?
Well, the main things would be for listeners who are considering travel to either parts of the country or parts of the world where Zika is a problem to become educated and aware. There's lots of good information available on the web through the CDC website, for example. And particular, if there are women who are pregnant or are considering becoming pregnant, they should look carefully at the risks and make an informed decision about whether or not the travel that they're planning at this time is worth it to them.
Does it strike you as remarkable that the World Health Organization's advice in Central and South America is don't get pregnant?
That's a good question. I think that advice regarding not getting pregnant is problematic, quite frankly. If you're a short-term traveler to a region, perhaps that makes sense. If you're living in the area, not so much. And in reality, that can only be something that can help as long as there is adequate reproductive health supplies, contraception available to women to minimize their risk.
Is enough being done to look for that vaccine?
There is a lot of work being done on the Zika vaccine. I was at a meeting today in Washington, D.C., with the director of CDC talking about there are already five potential vaccine candidates that have been developed by the NIH. The truth about vaccines, though, is that they do take a while both to develop and then to test to make sure that they're safe and effective. And so we're probably at least a year or more away from there being a vaccine that's available. And unfortunately, Zika is not waiting for that. And so this first year where the disease is in this country, we're going to need to make do with these other strategies that are so important to be funded and so important for local health to carry out.
We've said there are some confirmed cases of Zika in King County, in Western Washington, and, you know, more might be on the way as people travel and exchange. Do you think we should expect babies born with microcephaly here?
Well, the truth, unfortunately, is that we should expect babies born with microcephaly in a proportion of women who are pregnant when they get Zika. I certainly hope that we don't have any in our area, but despite the best efforts that health departments are going to be able to do, there are going to be some unfortunate pregnancies and birth defects that we see throughout the summer. Most of them are going to be in places in the country like Puerto Rico and the southern part of the United States where there are mosquitoes and therefore the rates of infection are much higher. The bottom line, though, is that we need to be prepared to see those cases, to offer support to women and babies, and to expect that despite the best efforts of local health departments, assuming that Congress releases money, that we're not going to be able to eliminate this disease altogether.
Finally, David, you said you wish local public health departments had more money to do education. You have a chance to educate right now on KUOW. What do you want to tell us?
Well, the education for Zika is important. It's one of those things where people need to hear it several times. But for Western Washington residents, the key messages about Zika are to inform yourself about the risks. If you're considering travel outside the area to other parts of the United States or to the rest of the world where there are mosquitoes, educate yourself about the risks and about the steps that you can take to reduce the risks. If you're a woman who's considering pregnancy, pay particular attention to the risks and at least consider whether or not that travel is something that you can defer to a later time.
Dr. David Fleming was with King County Public Health, now with Seattle-based global health organization PATH. The Centers for Disease Control has travel notices for Cape Verde, Mexico, the Caribbean, Central America, Pacific Islands, and South America. As Fleming said, we don't have the Zika-spreading sort of mosquito here in Western Washington. In Brazil today, the new health minister there said the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in August will be safe. He said there is minimal risk of contracting Zika for the 350 to 500,000 foreign visitors who are expected. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. America has been talking about sexual assault again since a Stanford University swimmer got his sentence for attacking a woman he met at a frat party. In Canada, the head of British Columbia's government has revealed that she was sexually assaulted at age 13. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer is with us. Hi, Vaughn.
Good morning, Bill, or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah. What did Christy Clark say?
Yeah, a very powerful admission by the Premier of British Columbia. Clark, in an opinion piece published in Vancouver Sun and then distributed around, basically said she realized why women remain silent in the face of sexual harassment and assault and attacks of all kinds. Because she did so herself. She recalled in the piece how, as a 13-year-old girl, she was dragged into the bushes by a molester. She managed to wriggle free. She went off to work, and she said she never told anybody about it. She's finally speaking out now, in large measure, simply to dramatize the need for women to report and speak out and say things. Because, as she said in a speech in the legislature, the silence is the rapist's friend. Framing all this, Bill, is a piece of legislation that was just passed by the British Columbia government requiring the province's colleges and universities to have more proactive policies for dealing with complaints on campus. There have been a number of women come forward and say they've complained about various kinds of harassment and sexual misconduct on campus. They've not received an adequate response from the university. The universities weren't even keeping records of this, so it wasn't possible to keep track of how much of a problem there was. So this legislation gets passed by the BC legislature this spring. It was proposed by the Green Party. Clark decided that her government would support it, but she said she thought it was important to also come forward and explain why she felt this was very, very important to do.
Well, what has been the reaction to Premier Clark's coming forward?
I would say the general reaction has been positive. Clark's critics, opposition politicians have said, praised the Premier for speaking out, saying they know it takes a certain amount of bravery, something that's been there for 37 years. This is how long ago this happened. At the same time, I think there's been some fair criticism of our government along the lines of, and what else are you going to do? British Columbia's rape relief centers say they're underfunded. There is a strong indication that programs to help women deal with violence and sexual violence in particular are not strong enough. There's not enough funding there. So, you know, and I think there's a certain amount of fair comment on that. There have been, you know, any time a politician does something, Bill, there's always somebody going to say, well, they're just looking at the polls and they're trying to get themselves reelected and all that.
Yes.
There's some of that. But I think in general, most of the response has been very good. Good of you to come forward and admit it. What else are you going to do?
You know, I have the sense, Vaughn, that there's a trend in the United States toward ending our silence. I've seen this happen. I've had conversations just recently with rape victims, with people who are addicted to substances, but also from sex workers, from transgender people saying that it's time to get past shame. I wonder if you have that same sense in Canada, in British Columbia.
I think that's quite true, Bill. And I think that's the most positive part of the Premier's message, to come forward and say we're going to do this. We had a very moving, powerful speech given by a member of the opposition in the legislature who got up and spoke in favor of this legislation. And she told a story about being chased by a naked man on the beach in front of the University of British Columbia campus 45 years ago. And she broke down in the middle of it. Like, it, you see this and you realize that these things never go away. They haunt people for years to come. So people deal with it. They don't tell people. But it's been a cathartic experience, I think, for a lot of people. And I think you're right, Bill. All of this stuff does help other people to come forward, to overcome the shame and to talk about it.
I saw someone in BC saying this is why we want more women in office. I want to.
Yes.
Yeah, you've heard that.
That too, you know. They bring stories that men cannot even imagine what goes on.
Hmm. Another subject now, Vaughn, in Seattle we're discussing how do we observe Pride Month after this massacre at a gay nightclub in Florida. I wonder what's the talk in Vancouver. You have Pride Month or Pride Parade there, I know.
Yeah, the Pride Parade in Vancouver will be at the end of July, Pride Weekend. I think it'll be very heavily attended this year. I think there obviously will be security. The police don't like to talk about that, but there will obviously have to be some sort of security. The one that everybody, I think, in Canada is watching is July the 3rd. The city of Toronto has its Pride Parade then. Mm. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has already pledged he'll be the first Canadian Prime Minister to walk in a Pride Parade. So I think we'll be watching that one again. I expect there'll be security, but I think it'll also be very, very heavily attended.
Vaughn Palmer from Vancouver Sun joining us as he always does on Wednesdays. Vaughn, thanks for the news from Canada. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye, Bill.
We're talking there at the top about the Premier of British Columbia, Christy Clark, revealing that she was the victim of an attempted sexual assault at age 13. Clark said that as British Columbia's first elected female premier, she has a public platform, and she wrote these words. She wrote, "Shame is painful. It's also pervasive and isolating. But the capacity to survive and heal is achievable through the sharing of our experiences. Our silence makes it easier for those who wish to harm us." You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. A bit of news that I know that Starbucks is aware of today, and Tully's and Victrola and Cafe Vita. The International Agency for Research on Cancer said today there's no conclusive evidence that cancer is caused by drinking coffee. The group had rated coffee as possibly carcinogenic, and they've now changed their mind. However, the IARC, also presented scientific evidence today suggesting that drinking anything very hot, including coffee, tea, water, anything above about 150 degrees, that probably does cause cancer of the esophagus. A World Health Organization spokesperson said, quote, "Be prudent, let hot drinks cool down." This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. Thanks for tuning in today.